This podcast was recorded at 2015 JADPRO Live at APSHO Conference. The title of this session is Risk Stratification in Multiple Myeloma, Putting the Pieces Together, and it is presented by Angelo Mayo, MS, PAC, Mayo Clinic Scottsdale, and Craig V. Reeder, MD, Mayo Clinic Scottsdale. To view the presentation slides or to claim continuing educational credit for this activity, please visit www.advancedpractitioner.com/JADPRO Live 2015. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Good afternoon. We have some financial disclosures. Dr. Reeder has received research funding from Celgene, Millennium, and Novartis, and I've received honoraria from Celgene, Millennium, and actually Amgen. And I'm on the Advanced Practice Provider Steering Committee for Celgene. Our objectives for today, we're going to start by talking about some of the agents for treatment of multiple myeloma and some of the basics of diagnosis for multiple myeloma, to understand and discuss the heterogeneous genetic nature of multiple myeloma, to learn about the basic prognostic factors and how they impact treatment choices and outcomes, to understand the role of stem cell transplantation, implement effective clinical strategies for minimizing toxicity, and to utilize some practical strategies for enhancing patients' adherence to treatment. To start, just a little background, a few multiple myeloma statistics. This is the second most common hematologic malignancy in the United States. It's far behind non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is the first by far. It's about 1.6% of all cancer diagnoses. So if you're working in the community where you see everything that comes in, this may be a relatively small percentage of what you see, but you will see it. It's almost 2% of all cancer deaths. There are over 20,000 new cases in the United States estimated in 2015. And the percentage of patients surviving is getting greater and greater thanks to a lot of new therapies and a lot of research being done in the area. But it's still not a treatable, still not a curable malignancy. Some of the risk factors for multiple myeloma. First of all, keep in mind most of your patients will not have any risk factors. They won't have any known predisposition. But men tend to get this a little more often than women. It congregates in elderly patients. The average age at diagnosis is 72. Pre-existing monoclonal gammopathy. We now know that everyone has pre-existing MGUS before they develop myeloma. Whether or not that's detected is a different story. So if your patient's been detected with monoclonal gammopathy, then you're surveying them and making sure they're not showing you any signs of progression. African Americans tend to have multiple myeloma at higher percentages than other ethnic groups. And while this is certainly a minority, there are some people with family history. We do have some brother and sister teams that both have multiple myeloma. So there is the potential for family history. Multiple myeloma, where we're going to find it. You'll find some plasma cells in the bone marrow when you do a bone marrow biopsy. In the blood, you'll be able to see intact immunoglobulins, IgA, IgG, IgM, and with the light chains. And you'll also be able to detect free light chains. Presenting signs and symptoms, probably the two biggest ways that I hear patients tell me they were diagnosed. One is anemia. They're having a workup for anemia, and this is discovered. The other one is pain, particularly things like back pain. People thinking, oh, I shouldn't have lifted that refrigerator, and they don't get better, and they don't get better, and they go to their primary doctor, and they don't get better, and someone x-rays and says, ew, what's going on here? Some people are identified when they're acutely ill. So if you do inpatient work, you may find the patient in renal failure. You may find a hypercalcemic patient, and that's their first presenting symptom, those people having pretty aggressive disease at that point. Many patients are asymptomatic. I've had patients come into me, they're diagnosed with hemoglobin of 6.8 and said, I felt pretty good, I was working. Now that I think about it, I guess I didn't feel that great, but you kind of become used to it when your hemoglobin gradually goes down over time. Making a diagnosis, many of the patients will probably come to you with a diagnosis already made, but if you're working inpatient in particular, you may be the one making this diagnosis. We need a CBC and a comp panel. We need to check the immunoglobulins in the serum. We need to do a serum protein electrophoresis, check for free light chains in the serum, and beta 2 microglobulin we'll talk about as a part of the staging. Urine, you want to get a 24-hour urine for protein electrophoresis on all your newly diagnosed patients. So this is a protein electrophoresis. If these have ever come to you and you said, what is all that squiggly stuff? If we look at the blue, that tells what a normal protein electrophoresis looks like. The predominant protein is albumin. If we see that kind of green color in the background, there's a spike in the gamma region. That's the M spike. Imaging is somewhat of a topic of discussion in multiple myeloma. People are saying, what test should I get? Not things such as a bone scan. These are lytic lesions. They're going to show up better on x-ray. Skeletal survey is always the gold standard, and skeletal survey is good because it's relatively inexpensive. You could get it done quickly, and you can survey the whole body. However, nowadays, sometimes we're using other methods of detecting, too. PET CT for people with AVID disease on PET CT. I have seen AVID disease on PET CT that did not show up on skeletal surveys at times. And then MRI, we'll talk a little bit about the high-risk smoldering myeloma and how we use MRI to determine if those people are actually progressing to active myeloma. We also use MRI if your patient complains you have a specific painful area. We want to evaluate a certain area in the spine. Sometimes MRI is very helpful at taking a real close look. Here's an example of a skeletal survey. This is a patient's skull. The patient has punched out lytic lesions, which you can see. Surprisingly, most of these patients with the lytic lesions in the skull are relatively asymptomatic from this. And this is a PET CT of a very nice individual that I had the privilege to care for. Unfortunately, at this stage in this PET CT, he had very AVID disease and even extramedullary presentation of myeloma, which is something that we do sometimes see. Myeloma doesn't have to be confined to the bone. Sometimes we can see in soft tissue and organ involvement, which usually portends a very poor prognosis. Do we have to do a bone marrow biopsy? What if you know what your patient has? You're doing a workup. They have an M spike. Everything's clear. They have anemia. Do you have to do a bone marrow biopsy? Absolutely, yes. You're going to get a lot more information from the bone marrow biopsy, which we'll talk about, and Dr. Reeder will be talking about the risk factors and how we can identify some of those, and it's definitely a part of the workup that we can't eliminate. When you do your bone marrow biopsy, they have less than 10% monoclonal plasma cells, and they're asymptomatic. They have monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance. You're going to follow those patients. You're going to see them on your calendar and say, ooh, I probably have an easy day. I just have to talk to this person about their M spike. Not all monoclonal gammopathy progresses to myeloma. It's a relatively small percent per year, depending upon the type and depending upon how it's behaving, risk of about 1 to 2% per year, but it is cumulative, so you do want to follow your patients. Multiple myeloma greater than 10% monoclonal plasma cells, and within that category, you're going to say, are they smoldering or are they active? If they don't have any evidence of end organ disease, then they're smoldering. If they have active, which we'll get to in a minute, those are people that are being harmed by their disease, and those are people that do require therapy. Here's the diagnostic criteria for symptomatic myeloma, which many of you probably are familiar with, CRAB. So we have elevated calcium, renal insufficiency, anemia or other cytopenias, and bone lesions. So that's traditionally how we differentiate it. You don't have any CRAB. I don't care how many plasma cells are in your bone marrow. You don't have active myeloma. You don't require therapy. The patient does have any one or more of these symptoms, and they are in need of therapy. This has changed a little bit in recent times. So in 2014, we have an update for high-risk smoldering myeloma. It's always rather uncomfortable to know that someone has pretty significant smoldering myeloma, and you don't want to sit and wait for them to break a bone. So now we're looking at what are some of the indications for therapy, even in the absence of the strict CRAB criteria. So things like 60% plasma cells on bone marrow biopsy, those patients, nearly all of them progressed within a year in a study. So we just kind of consider those active myeloma now, and we're going to go ahead and treat them. Patients that have a light chain ratio of over 100 from the involved over the uninvolved, whether it's kappa or lambda, ratio over 100, those people require therapy because they're at high risk. And then MRI, we sometimes use MRI of the patient's spine to identify lesions that may be subtle that maybe we didn't know were there previously. So this is a way that we can kind of get a step ahead of severe damage for our patients. The ISS staging system, a lot of your patients will probably ask you, what stage am I? And it's going to be radically different than when we stage something like colon cancer, for example. We stage a stage 1 colon cancer, they have surgery and they're done. They have a stage 4 colon cancer, then they have metastatic disease and they require palliative chemotherapy if they're going to proceed with that. Myeloma is a little different because we're going to use the same treatment whether they're stage 1, stage 2, or stage 3. We'll talk about some subtleties of which treatments to pick. There's only two pieces of information that we need to decide what stage a patient is in. They can both be obtained from the blood work. It's the beta 2 microglobulin and the serum albumin. If the beta 2 microglobulin is high, that's an indicator of high tumor burden, and beta 2 over 5.5 puts them into stage 3 disease. If a patient has an adequate albumin and a low beta 2 microglobulin, then they're a lower risk. They're a stage 1 patient. And then stage 2 is kind of the catch-all for everybody else that doesn't fit into those two criteria. So it's a little bit of a strange stage that you can get from two pieces of blood information. You don't have to check the beta 2 microglobulin month after month after month. You need it for staging up front. And the staging does make a difference because, as you can see, the stage one patients had a median survival of over 5 years, whereas the stage three were roughly around 2.5 years. We're talking about modifying the staging system, too, to include some of those high-risk factors, some of the high-risk genetics that we're going to discuss later today. ISS does correlate with survival, the staging. And myeloma in general is characterized by periods of relapse and remission. So the place where we've made the most progress in the world of myeloma is in this middle area. We have many, many new agents. I heard somebody yesterday refer to people who had been in the field a while as seasoned. Well, I guess I'm seasoned. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. But we've come up with many, many drugs. When I first started out, we had very few drugs. We had VAD, which was toxic, and it didn't work very well. And we had transplant for a select few patients, and we had oral melphalan, and then we had, sorry, I can't do anything else for you. Now we have agents that are more effective, more tolerable, and there are more of them. We're going to talk about some of those agents, and we're going to use all of them, or many of them, throughout the treatment process of many of our patients. And so now what we have is a lot more of those relapse and remissions. So the time that the patient is alive is extended. The quality of their life, hopefully, is extended because the agents are more tolerable. So that's where I think that we have reasons for optimism. However, over on that end of the chart where it says refractory and relapse, we definitely still see this. We still see people that have become resistant to all of their therapy and succumb to their disease. And generally speaking, we still call multiple myeloma an incurable disease, although we do have a few wonderful and fortunate people out there that are a couple decades from their diagnosis that seem to be cruising along just fine. Hopefully we'll have more in the future. So when we talk about giving someone myeloma therapy, this is one thing where you don't necessarily want to say, oh, I'm not going to treat you because you're kind of fragile or because you're anemic or you're not feeling, I'm not going to treat you. Because if you don't treat people, they're not going to feel well for the most part. So one of your immediate goals is we want to gain rapid control of the disease. We want to reverse some of the toxicities. If we give someone effective therapy, a lot of times we restage the patients after the first month of therapy, and sometimes before that point I'll be seeing the patient to check on them, and they'll say, my pain is so much better, I'm not needing those pain pills anymore, and I feel pretty good about that. And most of the time when we restage them at a month, they're making some improvements. Renal, if you're in the hospital or if you're in the outpatient setting and you see someone in renal failure from myeloma, effective prompt therapy can reverse that process. People can come off of dialysis and can make a huge difference. So that's something you really want to get on top of right away. And we also want to allow for stem cell collection if the patient is a candidate for an autologous transplant. Our long-term goals, we want the patient to live longer. We want to prevent them from having more toxicities. We want to prevent relapse. So those are some of the things that we're looking at long-term. So we want to talk about getting control right now, but we also want to remind our patients that it's kind of a marathon and not a sprint, and that it's going to be a disease that requires long-term therapy. So our phases of therapy, we have induction. Then we have transplant for a transplant-eligible patient, which we want to do our transplant after induction. If you're seeing this patient in the clinic and you're not at a transplant center and you think they might be a candidate, send them for an evaluation. We don't have a hard and fast age cutoff. We do consider things like that. We consider comorbidities, but there are some people in their 70s that are transplant candidates. There are some people who are in their 50s who are not. And the best thing to do is to kind of give them that option to talk to a transplanter up front. Then we want to do maintenance therapy. We no longer just treat people for a few months and say, all right, your numbers look good, let's see what happens. We know now that if we maintain people on therapy, they will often stay in remission for longer. And then eventually, unfortunately, most of them will relapse and we'll have to do some treatment there. This I'm going to skip over. We have lots of information, so this is for your future information. It's one of the induction therapies. And Dr. Reeder will talk a little more about how do we choose an induction therapy based on the individual patient. If you've seen myeloma patients, you probably know that there are some that just seem to keep cruising along and coming in, and they're taking their oral medication for years and they're good. And there's other people that, holy cow, it blows up, they get sick. So we're going to talk a little bit about who's who and how we treat them differently. Role of transplant, we had a good talk on transplant earlier this morning. So the bottom line is that it's an autologous transplant for myeloma. Age is one, but not the only factor that we consider. People, we want them to respond to induction therapy first. Unfortunately, one of the sad things that we sometimes do see is that social and financial reasons do play into whether people get transplanted or not. You need a caregiver, and that's problematic for some folks. There are people that can't be out of work to do their transplant, so we definitely try to work with those people as much as we can, but sometimes it is a decision that's made not just based on medical situation. So maintenance therapy after their induction therapy or their transplant, we may possibly put them on some maintenance regimens. I'm going to talk a little bit for the remainder of my time up here about some of the major drugs that you're going to see in the myeloma world, a couple of the side effects to look out for, and some of the practical things when you're managing those patients. So two major classes of myeloma therapy. We're coming up with more and more drugs. We have other classes of therapy, but we've got proteasome inhibitors and we've got IMIDs, and those two families of drugs have really revolutionized the way we treat myeloma today. So we'll start with the proteasome inhibitors. One thing I want to throw out for all the proteasome inhibitors as a class, which is bortezomib or Velcade and carfilzomib or Kyprolis. There are others up and coming, oral formulations of these drugs that we're looking at in clinical trials. One of the risks that we have is the risk of shingles. So we put everyone on some antiviral therapy, some prophylaxis antiviral therapy, because otherwise you will be seeing shingles. I remember when bortezomib was approved, and again, that's making me feel kind of old, but it was 2003. And it really changed the way we treat multiple myeloma. After this point, we saw the data showing a lot longer survival for our patients because this is a pretty well-tolerated drug. It's a very effective drug. If we're talking about side effects, one thing that I really want, one of the really basic things that you should really assess is for sensory neuropathy. Sensory neuropathy is less now than it was when this drug first came out. Now we're administering subcutaneously instead of IV, and that reduces the risk. Now we're often administering weekly instead of twice weekly, and that reduces the risk. But neuropathy, when we have our patients that are living 10 years or more, you don't want to give them the gift that keeps giving, which is terrible neuropathy. So you want to assess it. Not necessarily stop the drug at the first twinge in their feet, but you definitely want to continue to ask those questions. You may need to dose reduce. It's better to dose reduce someone and keep them on therapy than to cause them significant toxicity sometimes. Again, there's always a balancing act. If your patient's acutely ill, you may be willing to take a little more risk here than if someone is not that ill from their disease or if someone has a number of other therapeutic options. GI toxicity is relatively minor, but it is something that you'll hear about: nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and then fatigue, like all of our chemotherapy drugs. Traditionally, we don't routinely pre-medicate people with antiemetics that are getting bortezomib. If they have nausea, then certainly we can, but it's not reflexively something we do. I always send them home with something for nausea. Neuropathy, again, we won't have time to probably address all of this, but the way that neuropathy presents, what are your patients going to tell you? Let's say it's numb or tingly. It usually starts distally, usually feet first. And it may or may not be associated with pain. It's a big distinction to make. If their feet feel like they're falling asleep, it might be okay. If their feet hurt, that's not okay. That causes them a lot of problems. It can interfere with function as it progresses. It can interfere with fine motor skills and balance. Sometimes they'll describe it a little differently. It could be a cold sensation in the extremities, a burning feeling, sharp shooting pains. So those are questions that you really want to ask. Allodynia, sometimes people just get exquisitely sensitive to all sorts of sensation. The thing to keep in mind about neuropathy, there's some risk factors: older age, diabetes, prior chemotherapy, spinal stenosis. If you have an amyloid patient, they may already have neuropathy as part of their disease. Sometimes the paraprotein itself, the myeloma protein, can cause neuropathy before we even treat folks. Treatment, what you want to keep in mind is that treatment is not that effective overall. So if we're waiting until we're treating something that's very painful, we might have a hard time. So the best thing is to kind of prevent and minimize. But I have included some things here. ASCO recommendations, duloxetine is the only thing that's officially on their recommendations, and that's for moderate. People try some non-prescription things, such as alpha-lipoic acid, B vitamins, acupuncture and physical therapy, and sometimes just things like modification of environment. Like I had a patient who was going for a hike and said, now I have to take my hiking stick because I don't always know where my feet are in space. So those are all things to advise your patients on as well. And we have carfilzomib, which is the next generation proteasome inhibitor. This drug was FDA approved in 2012, so relatively recently. The clinical trial that approved this drug had a 22.9% overall response rate. You might think that's not that stellar. I actually participated in this trial, and the patients were very, very heavily pretreated. So for people that had a lot of prior therapy, for almost a quarter of them to respond was a big improvement. So initially, this drug was approved for relapsed and refractory disease as a single agent, and more recently, it has obtained a new FDA indication where we can give it with lenalidomide and dexamethasone in any relapsed setting. Before, it was initially approved for people who had already received bortezomib, already received an IMID, usually lenalidomide, and then they could go on carfilzomib. Now it's approved at first relapse, and it's in with lenalidomide and dexamethasone in combination. Very powerful combination, so very nice response rates to that drug. side effects, fatigue, cytopenias, some nausea. Some of the things that are a little bit different is that your patients might have kind of a flu-like reaction, usually the evening that they get their carfilzomib. You can often make this less severe by pre-medicating them with a little bit of dexamethasone. The standard pre-medication is 4 milligrams. If they're receiving it with Revlimid and dexamethasone in combination, they may get more of a therapeutic dose of dexamethasone. But if you give a little bit of dex before the carfilzomib goes in, we tend to see less of that. Dyspnea is reported by a third of patients. You want to look at the fluid balance. Traditionally, when we start giving this drug, we give it with kind of a lot of fluid, and from there we can give less if the patient tolerates it. You may want to watch that if you have a patient with some congestive heart failure, if you have a patient that's already edematous, you may want to cut back on that fluid, and you may be able to help their dyspnea that way. But those are things that your patients may tell you. Those are things that you want to look at for. Warnings. If someone already has pretty significant congestive heart failure or ischemia, you may want to watch them relatively closely. And another warning is that in the clinical trial, some tumor lysis syndrome did occur. Particularly, when we think of tumor lysis, we usually think of lymphoma. So if you have someone that has lymphoma-like presentation, if they have extramedullary disease, if they have big, bulky, soft tissue tumors, they're kind of at risk for tumor lysis. If you have patients with plasma cell leukemia, where if you see the plasma cells in their peripheral blood, that's a very aggressive disease, that's also a risk factor for tumor lysis. Now we're going to talk about the IMIDs, the immune modulating drugs, and we'll start with the oldest IMID, thalidomide. And so thalidomide in the 1960s was used for morning sickness in pregnant women, and many of you probably know the outcome of that. It was not good. Babies had severe birth defects. So they shelved thalidomide for a long time, and lo and behold, it worked for multiple myeloma. So back in 1998, it was approved on a limited basis, and they have a special risk management program that you're probably familiar with if you prescribe any of these IMIDs. I used to have to actually call this and help my patients with it, and I can still hear the lady's voice in my head. But that's to try to protect. We don't want any women who are pregnant or who could become pregnant to be exposed to this drug, which is very important. It's an oral drug, and when it first came out in the late 1990s, it was a great improvement over the other therapies that were available. With thalidomide, you want to watch out. There's a black box warning, so the fetal toxicity. Also thrombosis, which is a class effect. So thalidomide, lenalidomide, pomalidomide, increased risk of thrombosis. You're going to look at your patient and make an individual decision, but most of our patients are at the minimum on an aspirin, an 81 milligram aspirin. People who've had prior thrombotic events may be on full anticoagulation, either with warfarin or one of the newer anticoagulants. That's something that you want to prevent. They didn't prevent it up front when this drug first came out, and we saw a lot of clots. A cytopenia is probably less with thalidomide than many of our drugs. It tends to be well tolerated in terms of blood counts. Neuropathy with this drug does occur. It tends to be progressive. It tends to be the longer you've been on it, the more likely someone is to get it. It tends to not be reversible, so you really want to stay on guard with patients who've been on thalidomide for a while. Thalidomide often is, we think of it as being a little less used these days with some of the newer IMIDs, but it is actually still used, and it's also useful as an adjunct therapy. So we do use it. Then we have lenalidomide, which was FDA approved in 2005 for relapsed and refractory disease. And then just this year was approved for initial therapy in patients. This is an oral therapy. Your patients may really like that. It's well tolerated. I had a wonderful woman who went and tended a lighthouse. And the only way you could get to this lighthouse was by a ferry. And she was going to stay there for a month. And that was just one of her dreams. And she got to do this. And guess what? She took her lenalidomide with her. And she took it. And she was able to stay on myeloma therapy and enjoy that experience. Often we use this as induction therapy for older patients. And it has the same black box warning as thalidomide regarding the fetal toxicity, the clot risk, and the cytopenias. I always tell all my patients on IMIDs, I tell them, what are the signs of a blood clot? Explain to them, if one of your legs is red, we need to know right away. If you're short of breath and we don't understand why, we need to know right away. And teach them what to look for. Also, if they're going on a long trip, I tell them to move around. I try to give them a little preventative coaching there without scaring them like crazy, hopefully. Common side effect, lenalidomide cytopenias. So when you have a new patient on this drug, you want to check their CBC fairly often. We often check weekly for the first month or two to make sure that they're not going to become neutropenic. Diarrhea also can occur. Muscle cramps, people tell you they have these Charlie horse kind of sharp shooting pains. Usually those are managed. We can use things like I've told people to drink tonic water. One of our doctors tells people to drink pickle juice. If you can stomach pickle juice, apparently it helps. Fatigue, like all of our drugs. And now one thing to keep in mind with lenalidomide, we sometimes use it for induction, but it can impair our ability to collect stem cells. So you don't want your patient on lenalidomide for 2 years and then say, I think I'm going to go try to collect some stem cells. If you think you might transplant this person ever, you're going to treat them first up front for, I don't know, maybe 4 months or so. Then you're going to collect their cells. And if you decide to go back to lenalidomide and not transplant them, then you've got your cells and you can go back without worry about impairment. There's some question regarding the increased risk of secondary malignancies, hematologic malignancies, which seems to be in association with patients who've also been transplanted and who are on lenalidomide. So we want to watch for cytopenias. We want to watch for MDS or AML type symptoms that are not extremely common, but could definitely be serious if they did occur. And then we have pomalidomide, which is the third generation IMiD drug, and this was approved just back in 2013. And so this can still be an effective drug, even if your patient has failed the other IMiD. It was originally approved in 2013 for relapsed and refractory patients who have already had lenalidomide, who have already had bortezomib, because those were our two gold standards. We give it with dexamethasone. It does definitely seems to work better with dexamethasone. We've done a trial where they had some people with dexamethasone and some without, and I remember quite clearly someone who wasn't responding. We added a little bit of dex, and it turned out to be a pretty good drug for him. And pomalidomide also appears promising in combination with proteasome inhibitors. Same black box warning, fetal toxicity, thromboembolism, particularly DVT and PE, cytopenias. The side effects seem to be a little more of a cross, a little more neuropathy than lenalidomide, a little more low blood counts than thalidomide. So it seems to be a little bit of a hybrid, but you want to look for all of those things. But often for patients, again, a well-tolerated oral therapy for their myeloma. Other drugs in use, we definitely use alkylating agents. Cyclophosphamide, often we use oral cyclophosphamide in combination, and there's some data in there about cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. We use melphalan oral, and we use melphalan IV as our conditioning for transplant. Steroids, which everybody knows and hates, dexamethasone and prednisone, your patients will be on them for most of the myeloma therapies. Liposomal doxorubicin is also approved, and panobinostat is the newest drug to be FDA approved in March of 2015 for relapsed refractory disease. Clinical trials, Dr. Reeder has some information about that as well, but I just really have to put in a plug for clinical trials. A lot of these drugs were recently clinical trials. We did clinical trials with pomalidomide. We did clinical trials with carfilzomib. This is how we're making that survival better. The hot drug that you will probably be hearing from in the very near future, monoclonal antibodies, anti-CD38 antibodies. To be really quick and dirty, it's kind of like the myeloma equivalent of rituximab. These drugs are in late-phase clinical trials and be looking at the FDA for approval in the near future for some of these medications. We're looking at ways to help the immune system be involved. We're looking at oral forms of some of our drugs, like oral proteasome inhibitors. We're looking at genetic sequencing. We're looking at gene profiling to try to tell us more about what are people going to respond to, what's their risk status. And so as of the time that I wrote this, there were 13 open trials for multiple myeloma at our center and 7 that were pending. So if you ever feel like you're stumped with a patient, you don't have to wait until their very end stage to talk about a clinical trial. So feel free to call us or feel free to call your local center that has a lot of clinical trials and see if there's anything that might be of benefit to your patients. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to one of my wonderful supervising physicians, Dr. Reeder.
Thank you, Angela. Very nice introduction. Thank the organizers for inviting us to talk today. And it's always hard to follow Angela. She's a great speaker and did a great job. Although pickle juice doesn't work in my experience for muscle cramps, but we've all tried it. So we've made a lot of progress over the last 3 decades in learning about myeloma. And one thing we know is it's not one disease. It's really many diseases, and just analogous to what we've learned in acute leukemia over the last few years, that the chromosome abnormalities often predict what the disease is going to do and what drugs might work for the disease, and the same thing is true now for multiple myeloma. When we first started looking at myeloma genetics, the chromosome makeup, metaphase chromosomes are often normal in multiple myeloma because the cells aren't dividing rapidly. And then the development of FISH, fluorescent in situ hybridization with antibodies that are fluorescent, you can identify mutations, extra chromosomes in the plasma cells that we didn't see with routine cytogenetics. And that's really changed the landscape of how we manage multiple myeloma now. Here's the usual kind of picture of a routine metaphase cytogenetics, and this is a normal pattern. What we rarely see is an abnormal pattern with metaphase cytogenetics, and one thing to remember is that when you do see an abnormal metaphase cytogenetics patient in a patient with multiple myeloma, that's usually a high-risk feature. Those patients don't tend to do well. This is a picture of a fish. In this particular translocation is 1114 translocation, which is a fairly well-described mutation. And again, just showing you how these will light up, and you can see the mutation of 11 and 14 together. The importance of the FISH studies is shown on this slide, and this was published by my colleague, Dr. Rafael Fonseca, over 10 years ago now, showing that the different mutations we find with FISH are prognostic. And the top green curve, you can see the 1114 translocation and other things like hyperdiploid or extra chromosomes as being a relatively good prognostic profile. We used to actually call that good risk, and now we refer to it more as standard risk. The changes of the translocations 414, 1416, 1420, and deletion of chromosome 17 are high-risk features and portend a poor prognosis. And this is an example just showing what happens when you treat even with modern three-drug regimens. This is a group of patients treated with Cytoxan, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. And if you look at the higher-risk 414 translocation and deletion 17, their progression-free survival is markedly different from patients that don't have those high-risk cytogenetics. We also know that stem cell transplant, which is a very common treatment modality for patients with myeloma, doesn't change the poor prognostic factors. And you can see here the patients that even with transplant, those that have a 414 translocation have a shorter survival after transplant. So the genetic classification is really two different groups of patients. There's the hyperdiploid. Those patients have extra copies of chromosomes, and it's usually the odd number of chromosomes. So it could be chromosome 5, 9, 11, 17, or 19 frequently, 15 frequently, and that's a good prognostic profile. The non-hyperdiploid myelomas tend to do worse, and this includes some of those high-risk translocations or hypodiploidy, where they're fewer than the normal number of chromosomes. And the particularly bad FISH translocations I've listed there, the 414, 1416, and then, of course, deletion 17. So the non-hyperdiploid group, there is the 1114 translocation, which is in that group, but this is actually one of the better prognostic markers. Now, conversely, that is sometimes the most common one seen in patients that have plasma cell leukemia. So the FISH profile by itself doesn't tell you what the patient's necessarily going to do. It's also associated with IgM myeloma, which is a rare form of myeloma, and patients that have CD20 positive plasma cells will usually see the 1114 translocation. Translocation 414, again, is a poor prognostic marker. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The 1416 translocation, another poor prognostic marker, not as common. 1420, another bad prognostic marker, but relatively uncommon. And probably the worst thing that we can find in FISH is deletion of 17P, and that usually involves deletion of P53. I'll just mention the deletion of chromosome 13, which is a very common mutation in myeloma. When you find it only by FISH, it doesn't have any real prognostic significance. It's highly associated with other mutations that are of poor prognosis. But if that's the only mutation you find on FISH, it really is not a bad prognostic marker. So myeloma prognosis, a lot of things are involved. We worry about the genetics of the disease, but also the age, performance status, the stage of the disease, as Angela mentioned, stage 1, 2, and 3, and then whether or not patients have a response to therapy. And it's important to know what the prognosis is when you're talking to a patient. So we want to be able to find what is a high-risk patient and treat them appropriately. We talked about the FISH, also the metaphase cytogenetics abnormality is a high-risk feature. If you do a test to look at the proliferative index, we commonly do a plasma cell labeling index. When that's high, that's a poor prognostic factor. Plasma cell leukemia, of course, is patients have a relatively poor outcome. High LDH is a very strong prognostic marker. Beta 2 microglobulin and albumin, of course, because they're part of the international staging system criteria. And also failure to respond to one of the novel agents. So if you have a patient that's on Revlimid and dexamethasone or bortezomib and dexamethasone for induction therapy and fails to have a response, those patients do quite poorly. And this is just, this actually from Dr. Gertz presented this a couple years ago, showing that even with transplantation, the difference in patients that have a plateau or response to their novel agent before they go to transplant versus those that are refractory. There's a very different outcome with, as far as survival. Gene expression profiling is one of the newest tools we have to look at the genetic makeup of the plasma cell. And this was first done at University of Arkansas, and the French group did shortly after that, and showed that a certain signature, they could predict what the prognosis was. And the problem was, in the first two studies that were done looking at the gene expression profile, there wasn't much overlap between the two different signatures. And I think there are other people doing signature profiling now, and hopefully over time we'll see that we're going to have the best profile to tell us what's going to happen. This is from the Arkansas group, and you can see there are two distinct signatures that predicted for outcome in myeloma. So I'm going to talk a little bit about MSMART now. This is the Mayo stratification for myeloma and risk adapted therapy. And this is a consensus from all the people at Mayo involved with myeloma care. And it's based on the genetics and also other prognostic factors that we just mentioned. And this is something that we actually put on the internet. There's a msmart.org. You can go to that site, and site is updated every year or two. There'll be a new update after ASH in December. Probably in January we'll have a new update. I'm not going to go through the fine print here, but just to mention that this is a risk stratification to individualize treatment for the patient. It also takes in not just the cytogenetic risks, but stage of the disease, LDH, and other factors. Now, this is the classification looking at mainly at the genetic makeup. Their high-risk patients are over on the left, again showing you the mutations by FISH. We also put in there the high-risk GEP signatures. We think that's high-risk. Intermediate, now, I mentioned earlier the 414 translocation we used to consider a high-risk mutation, but we put it in the intermediate group, and I'll explain that in just a minute. Deletion 13, then there's standard risk. Patients that have the extra chromosomes, the hyperdiploid patients, 1114 and the 614. So if you look at the 414 patients, we now realize that that is not really always a high-risk feature. If you combine that with the ISS stage, and this study was published a couple years ago in Leukemia, patients that have the 414, if they have low staging system, they don't do as bad. But the 414 translocation will lower each stage prognosis. You can see the blue curve at the top is absence of 414, and then the red curve below that is the presence. But that's still doing much better than the patients that don't have the 414 translocation who are at advanced stage disease. So we now think this is more of an intermediate risk factor. So this is guidelines for management of patients based on their risk, their standard risk, intermediate, and high risk. And again, patients that have hyperdiploid, the trisomies, or the 1114 translocation, patients can be managed with Revlimid and dexamethasone. They could be treated with Cytoxan, Velcade, dexamethasone, the Cyborg regimen, which we commonly will use. We'll often offer those patients transplant after their induction therapy. And then you can continue on therapy afterwards if they don't have a good response. Patients that have intermediate risk, we feel very strongly that they need to have a bortezomib-based therapy or another proteasome inhibitor-based therapy. We offer them transplant as well. but they need to have some maintenance therapy or consolidation afterwards with a proteasome inhibitor. The high-risk patients, 17P especially, patients need to have all drugs up front. We need a proteasome inhibitor, an IMID, dexamethasone with that, for the best outcome. It's important to get those patients rapidly into as deep a response as possible to, and then take them to transplant and then continue therapy afterwards. Because transplant, as I showed you earlier, for the 17 deleted and the 14, 16 patients, if you just transplant and don't put them on any kind of maintenance therapy, they'll all relapse within about 6 months. The same scheme holds true if you're not going to do transplant, but you obviously need to continue therapy longer for the standard risk patients. The RD patients, we keep those continually on Revlimid and dexamethasone. There's no need to take them off. Cyborg D, if you're not going to go to transplant, they're not eligible, then continue therapy for a year, and then you can observe. Same for the high-risk patients. You need to continue them on primarily triplet therapy, or at least have a proteasome inhibitor long-term to try and maintain their remission. So high-risk myeloma, we need to get a complete response for long-term control. You need to have very aggressive therapy, usually a triplet regimen, VRD, KRD. We're waiting for the results of the endurance trial, which is comparing carfilzomib to bortezomib, kind of head-to-head for newly diagnosed patients, and hopefully we'll have that information in the next couple of months. The intermediate-risk patients, the Cyborg-D or VCD regimen, is an adequate therapy. And then for standard-risk patients, we know survival is the same. Whether or not you put them in a complete remission or a very good partial remission, they're still going to have a good outcome. So you can do more of a sequential therapy rather than giving all the drugs up front. This shows results of what we're doing with modern therapy. This is the group of the Cyborg-D patients looking at long-term survival with triplet therapy. For all patients, overall survival now is over 70% at 5 years. If you break it down by their FISH, their high-risk versus standard-risk patients, it's still clear that the standard-risk patients are going to do very well. And at 6 years, over 80% of patients are still alive. So the usual treatment paradigm, Angela talked about induction therapy, then transplant, continuing therapy versus going to transplant is maybe an option for some patients. So I'm going to attend just a couple more things about stem cell transplant. Most of the transplant studies done have shown improvement in progression-free survival compared to standard therapy without transplantation. A couple of them show overall survival benefit as well. The next point is that it's a very low risk procedure. The mortality is about 1%. So even in elderly patients in their 70s, if they have minimal other comorbidities, they ought to be considered for a transplant. We know that transplant deepens the response. So patients typically after induction therapy, hopefully will have a partial, very good partial response, even maybe a near complete response, they're going to benefit by going through transplant. Second, transplants after patients have had a relapse are still considered. It doesn't seem to do much good if patients have a very short remission after their first transplant, but if someone's had a remission of a year and a half or 2 years, we will usually do a second transplant, at least offer it. I'm going to skip this slide for time's sake and mention just some points about the induction therapy of patients going to transplant. Thalidomide probably doesn't have any effect or decremental effect on our ability to harvest stem cells, but lenalidomide can. If patients have more than 4, 5, or 6 months of therapy with lenalidomide, it's harder to collect stem cells. Until we had the drug AMD-3100 or Mozabil, if those patients could be tough to get stem cells from. Bortezomib doesn't have any impact on the ability to collect stem cells. And the other chemotherapy drugs like the alkylating agents, we showed with the Cyborg-D regimen that Cytoxan is not a problem. However, melphalan is. Melphalan is very toxic to stem cells. So if a patient's had induction therapy with a melphalan-based regimen, it can be impossible to collect stem cells. Maintenance therapy. Thalidomide was studied several different clinical trials to look and see if this would improve survival. And most of the studies showed benefit, not just in progression-free survival, but some showed overall survival benefit. The problem with thalidomide was the toxicity. A very high percentage of the patients actually came off the studies because of profound fatigue, constipation, and neuropathy. Lenalidomide is studied now in two different trials looking at the benefits. Both trials show benefits in progression-free survival. One of them shows some overall survival benefit. The concern with lenalidomide maintenance has been a secondary cancer risk, which appears to be a real phenomenon. The risk is not terribly high, and many proponents of lenalidomide maintenance say that the benefit of being in remission longer with your myeloma outweighs the risk of a second cancer. There is some early data with bortezomib maintenance. It does appear to be active. We don't know what the right schedule is. I think a lot of people are using this at every two-week kind of schedule, sometimes Cytoxan, bortezomib, dexamethasone every 2 weeks for the intermediate or high-risk patients. So patients that have had a very aggressive relapse, that relapse with new mutations, they may have quieter 17p deletion or might have extramedullary disease or plasma cell leukemia. One of the regimens that can be effective is infusional therapy with DT-PACE or VDT-PACE. This is infusional therapy typically done in the hospital. It's very active, very effective. It's profoundly myelosuppressive, but it can get you results. It can get you a patient back in a remission, but unfortunately those patients won't stay in remission. You need to have a final plan. So if you take somebody to give them VDT-PACE, you have to get them to another transplant or you have to get them on a clinical trial because this won't produce any real long-term responses. It's kind of a bridge to some other therapy. Future therapies. So some of the newer drugs Angela mentioned, we have now oral proteasome inhibitors, ixazomib or MLN9708. Oprosimib, which is more akin to carfilzomib, is studied. Monoclonal antibodies are some of the most exciting new drugs that are coming along in myeloma. KSP inhibitors, histone deacetylase inhibitors like penobinostat, which was, of course, recently approved. AKT inhibitors, BCL2 inhibitors, where we have an ongoing trial right now with an oral drug, ABT-199, that's showing some pretty impressive results in subtypes of multiple myeloma. So that's very exciting. Dinacyclib is a trial that we have at Mayo right now. The nuclear transport selinexor is a trial we have ongoing right now at Mayo. I'm going to just skip ahead and mention the 38 antibodies. So CD38 is present on nearly all plasma cells, and there are two drugs now that are being looked at in clinical trials, one daratumumab, and the other one is still abbreviated SAR. From Sanofi. Both of these have gone through phase one and now in phase two, and even for daratumumab, phase three trials. And we're hoping that this is going to be like a rituximab for myeloma. And this is one of the early studies looking at responses. Patients that had the full dose, 16 milligrams per kilogram dose, 35% response rate. And this is in heavily pretreated patients that have refractory myeloma. So that's really a pretty impressive result. So I think what we're going to see now is that drug combined with other active agents and see the drug moved up front to induction therapy like we saw with rituximab. So to summarize, baseline genetic information should be obtained in all cases of multiple myeloma. The minimal testing needed is FISH panel, LDH, beta 2 microglobulin, and albumin. So the ISS staging, FISH and LDH. GEP signatures, I think ideally we'll get more information and know where to use those, and I think eventually they're going to be more powerful than doing FISH. Again, there are multiple tools you have to risk stratify your patient, and then risk determination is going to be important for you to guide your patient to have the best outcome. This is a group of our myeloma consultants in Rochester, Arizona, and Florida. And I think we'll stop. We've got a couple minutes for questions.
Hi, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you very much, Julie Ponto from Rochester. I'm just wondering if any of the genetic alterations are more or less common by race or ethnicity. So is there a prevalence of any of the particular genetic alterations in African Americans or Caucasians, or has that been looked at?
I'm not sure that's been looked at. I can't answer that. I'm not sure it's looked at.
I saw something that was, I don't know that it was conclusive, but I was doing some research about African Americans and multiple myeloma, that actually more of them seem to have hyperdiploid or less aggressive disease, but sometimes their outcomes still were less favorable, and so that was one of the things that we were looking at is how to treat those people more effectively.
This concludes this podcast from the 2015 Job Pro Live at OPSHO Conference. To view these slides and claim your educational credit, or to view other programs from this meeting, please visit education.annenberg.net/JobProLive2015.